compromise between pure judicial impartiality and the political necessity of obtaining state consent. If a state is a party to a contentious case and does not have a judge of its nationality on the bench, it is allowed to select an additional person, an ad hoc judge, to sit for that case only.
If the point of the court is impartiality, why on earth would you allow a clearly partisan appointee into the judicial chamber?
The rationale is, well, it's political persuasion. The system exists to encourage states to submit cases in the first place. The thinking is, if we give them a judicial officer who can participate in deliberations, who can articulate their perspective and ensure they feel the court has truly heard them, they are more likely to agree to jurisdiction.
And more likely to comply with the ruling.
Hopefully, it is the necessary political compromise that sacrifices pure impartiality for consent.
But if the data shows the permanent judges already favor their home country, doesn't introducing a temporary judge explicitly appointed by one party just make the process look rigged?
That's the criticism, exactly. While the ad hoc judge is required to take the same solemn declaration of impartiality as the permanent judges, the reality is they almost invariably vote in favor of the stay that appointed them. In a two-party dispute, the two ad hoc judges often cancel each other out, but their presence ensures the political appearance of fairness, which, in international law, is sometimes just as important as the fairness itself.
It seems like the constant theme is that even in the judicial sphere, the ICJ must prioritize obtaining consent over perfect justice. This leads us directly into Section 3, the constraints on the ICJ's operational power.
This section really addresses the core operational constraint. The ICJ is wholly defined by consent. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the court's authority is never inherent. It must always be granted by the sovereign states appearing before it.
Right. Unlike a domestic court, where if you break a law, jurisdiction is compelled, the world court cannot compel a state to appear. So, jurisdiction in contentious cases, where only states can be parties, is strictly founded upon the consent of the states involved. How do states grant this consent under Article 36? There are four foundations.
First, the most straightforward and arguably the most reliable, the compromise or special agreement. This occurs when a dispute has already arisen and the two states involved explicitly agree to write up an agreement to submit that specific case to the ICJ.
Why is this the most reliable basis for jurisdiction?
Because both parties actively want a legal resolution, they have already made the conscious decision to abide by the outcome. Therefore, compliance with the final judgment is historically much, much higher in these cases.
Okay, what's the second foundation of consent?
Compromissory clauses. These are pre-existing clauses embedded within a binding treaty, say the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations or the Genocide Convention, that stipulate that any future disputes related to that treaty will automatically be referred to the ICJ.
This sounds powerful, but it relies entirely on states honoring that commitment when a crisis actually hits, which, as history shows, they don't always do.
That's the major vulnerability. The sources highlight the Iran hostage crisis as a classic example. The U.S. brought a case against Iran based on a compromissory clause in the Vienna Convention. The ICJ delivered a judgment, but Iran just refused to participate and ignored the ruling. The clause was legally valid, but politically irrelevant in that context.
Which brings us to number three, the optional clause declaration, sometimes misleadingly called compulsory jurisdiction. I want to take some time on this because this is where the U.S.'s historical resistance is most visible.
This is Article 36(2) jurisdiction. States voluntarily declare that they accept the ICJ's jurisdiction over certain types of disputes with other states that have made similar declarations. It's voluntary because the state chooses to make the declaration, but once made, jurisdiction becomes mandatory for disputes covered by it.
But the word compulsory is highly misleading here because states often attach extensive reservations, right? They effectively give jurisdiction with one hand and take it back with the other.
They do. These reservations are crucial. States often exclude whole categories of disputes, like national security, ongoing hostilities, or very commonly, disputes over maritime boundaries. They are agreeing to play the game, but only on their terms.
How widespread is this mechanism today?
It's far from universal. As of 2018, only 74 states had an optional clause declaration in force. And critically, among the five permanent members of the Security Council, only the United Kingdom maintains one, and even theirs is highly reserved. The U.S. withdrew its acceptance entirely in 1986 after the Nicaragua case.
If the optional clause is so easy to withdraw and so heavily qualified, why do states bother with it at all? Doesn't that make the court's authority here illusory?
It certainly makes it fragile. States maintain these declarations primarily for political optics and to encourage a general respect for the rule of law. It lets them argue for judicial resolution when they are the plaintiff. The moment they anticipate being the defendant in a costly case, however, they can simply withdraw their acceptance, which many have done.
What's the final fourth foundation of jurisdiction?
Article 36.5, jurisdiction, which provides for the continuation of jurisdiction based on declarations made under the old Permanent Court of International Justice statute. It's essentially a bridge mechanism to ensure commitments made to the predecessor court remain valid.
Now, beyond settling the final dispute, the court has the ability to act quickly to preserve the situation while the case is ongoing. This is the incidental jurisdiction dealing with interim measures.
This is Article 41, and it is a powerful tool. These are binding interim measures, essentially the international equivalent of a restraining order or an injunction. They are designed to protect the rights of a party or prevent irreparable harm pending a final judgment. However, the court can only issue these if it is satisfied that prima facie jurisdiction exists, meaning they have to have enough initial evidence to believe they will have the right to hear the final case.
And we saw this power exercised recently with the order for Russia to suspend military operations in Ukraine in 2022. That was an interim measure,
which, despite being binding, was ultimately ignored, further highlighting the enforcement gap. An excellent point that ties back to the central tension. In addition to contentious cases between states, the court has a second major function, issuing advisory opinions. These are non-binding, but tremendously influential in defining international law.
Who is authorized to request these opinions, and on what grounds?
They can only be requested by specified UN bodies and agencies, primarily the General Assembly or the Security Council, on any legal question. Other UN organs need General Assembly authorization and must restrict the request to legal questions within their scope of activities.
While they don't settle an actual dispute, they carry enormous moral and legal weight. They essentially clarify what the law is for the global community. Our sources highlight a massive ongoing example right now involving climate change that shows the sheer scope of this power.
Yes, the 2025 Advisory Opinion on State Obligations in Respect of Climate Change is one of the most significant actions in the court's history. It was requested by the General Assembly to address crucial, evolving legal questions. What are states' obligations regarding anthropogenic emissions? What are the legal consequences for states that cause significant harm to the climate system?
The scale of the input for this opinion is just staggering. Why is hearing from 99 countries and 12 intergovernmental organizations so unprecedented?
It demonstrates the global consensus that the ICJ is the only authoritative body capable of tackling a legal question of this magnitude. For nearly 100 nations to line up and offer legal arguments, often highly sophisticated, divergent arguments, shows the world views the ICJ as the necessary catalyst for legal definition. Even though the opinion won't be binding, it will provide the legal foundation for future climate negotiations, treaties, and potentially future contentious cases. It defines the goalposts.
That reflects the court's powerful role as the authoritative legal voice defining international norms. But this leads us to the critical weakness, the major flaw in the entire system, the enforcement gap.
This is the shadow that hangs over every ICJ ruling. Its judgments are legally binding and final on the parties, but the court itself possesses no police power, no army, and no formal enforcement mechanism. Compliance is entirely reliant on the good faith and political calculation of the states involved.
So if a state decides to ignore a binding judgment, the only avenue for recourse is political, taking the issue to the Security Council.
Article 94 of the UN Charter establishes this pathway. If a state doesn't comply, the injured party can bring the matter before the Security Council, which can then make recommendations or decide upon measures to give effect to the judgment.
But this is where the ICJ hits the brick wall of geopolitical reality, the P5 veto. If the judgment is against one of the five permanent members or a close ally they wish to protect, they can simply veto the enforcement resolution. The law is nullified by a political act.
And we don't have to speculate about this failure mechanism. We have the classic painful precedent, the Nicaragua case. This case is the prime illustration of the enforcement crisis.
Let's delve into that because it is the ultimate example of a legal victory being politically erased.
Yeah.
What was the core legal finding in 1986?
The case, Nicaragua v. United States, focused on the U.S.'s covert military and paramilitary activities against Nicaragua, including mining harbors and supporting Contra rebels. The ICJ found the United States guilty of breaching customary international law, including the principles of non-intervention and the non-use of force. It explicitly ruled that the U.S. owed reparations to Nicaragua.
A clear, unequivocal legal victory for a small, developing state. What happened next?
The U.S. initially challenged the court's jurisdiction, and then when the court affirmed it, the U.S. just refused to participate further. Crucially, when Nicaragua brought the judgment before the Security Council seeking enforcement under Article 94, the United States used its veto power to block the resolution.
So the U.S. legally lost, but politically won.
Precisely. The outcome had two devastating consequences for the global rule of law. First, the ICJ's judgment was rendered unenforceable by the very mechanism designed to uphold it. Second, the United States subsequently withdrew its acceptance of the ICJ's compulsory jurisdiction under the optional clause entirely. It was a clear statement. We reserve the right to decide when and where we will submit our sovereignty to international judicial review.
If that's the tension, the legal versus the political, what does that mean for a small state like Nicaragua that won the legal fight but lost the political one? What was the final takeaway?
The final takeaway is cynical but crucial. International law matters, but only until it conflicts with the vital national interests of a P5 member. For small states, winning at the ICJ is a powerful moral and legal victory, which they can use in the court of public opinion, but they cannot expect physical compliance if the Security Council gate is locked by a veto.
The sources also point out a tricky conflict of authority between the ICJ and the Security Council, even when it's not a P5 member being judged, as seen in the Pan Am case.
This conflict highlights which body truly holds the trump card. In 1992, Libya asked the ICJ to order provisional measures to stop the U.S. and U.K. from imposing economic sanctions on them, sanctions which had been authorized by the Security Council regarding the Lockerbie bombing suspects. The ICJ ultimately decided it could not issue those measures.
And the legal reasoning was rooted in the U.N. Charter itself.
It was. Article 103 of the U.N. Charter is clear. Obligations under the Charter, which includes Security Council resolutions, take precedence over any other treaty obligations. Since the sanctions were authorized by the Security Council, the ICJ was legally bound to defer to its political power.
It is a constant, unavoidable dance between law and the raw exercise of political power. We've seen the rules and the limits. Let's move to Section 4 and look at some specific contentious cases that better illustrate the court's scope and impact.
We have to start with the most notorious enforcement failure we just discussed. The Nicaragua case remains the definitive illustration of how the Security Council bottleneck can nullify a clear legal ruling.
But the ICJ isn't just about conflicts involving superpowers. It plays a critical role in resolving complex issues of sovereignty, boundary disputes, and resource claims between neighboring states that might otherwise lead to armed conflict.
Absolutely. Consider DRC v. Uganda in 2005. The court ruled in favor of the Democratic Republic of Congo, finding that Uganda had violated DRC sovereignty and ordering payment for lost resources and damage caused during the Second Congo War. This ruling showed the court's ability to tackle severe historical grievances, though again, the payment compliance relies on political will.
How about cases involving treaty breaches between European neighbors?
In 2011, we had North Macedonia v. Greece. This centered on the 1995 Interim Accord, where Greece agreed not to object to North Macedonia's membership in international organizations under its provisional name. The ICJ found that Greece had breached that accord by vetoing North Macedonia's accession to NATO. The court's ruling clarified the specific obligation Greece owed, forcing the political issue back to the negotiating table.
Let's discuss the most high-profile ongoing challenge, Ukraine v. Russia, 2022. This case is particularly instructive because it focuses on the legal pretext for invasion rather than the invasion itself.
This case is a fascinating exercise in legal interpretation. Ukraine argued that Russia was falsely claiming genocide in the Donbas region, misusing the 1948 Genocide Convention as a legal justification or pretext for its special military operation. Ukraine asked the court to rule that no genocide was occurring and that Russia had no legal basis under the convention to invade.
And the court acted swiftly on the requested interim measures.
It did. On March 16, 2022, only weeks after the invasion began, the court ordered Russia to immediately suspend the military operations. This order was passed by a highly significant 13-2 vote, with only the Russian and Chinese judges dissenting.
That interim order was legally binding on Russia under international law. But what is the ultimate practical reality of that ruling?
The reality is that Russia simply ignored it. The military operations continued unabated. The source material is unequivocal. The ICJ cannot enforce it. This case teaches us that while the court can issue the most morally and legally compelling orders, it cannot overcome the political calculus of a determined P5 member. Its power is purely declarative.
The court also isn't afraid to say no, even to states trying to leverage it for political gain. It has dismissed cases where jurisdiction simply did not exist.
A textbook example is the complaint brought by the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia against NATO actions during the Kosovo War in 1999. The ICJ denied jurisdiction, finding that the FRY was not actually a party to the ICJ statute at the time the application was made. Jurisdiction has to be established first.
So when the court does decide a case, what body of law is it actually applying? You mentioned Article 38 of the statute earlier, which codifies the sources of international law.
It applies international law derived from those three core sources: international conventions or treaties, international custom, and the general principles of law. It also relies on judicial decisions and the teachings of highly qualified publicists as subsidiary means for determining rules of law.
It's critical to note, though, the difference between the ICJ and, say, a U.S. or U.K. common law court regarding precedent. The ICJ is not formally bound by stare decisis.
That is a crucial distinction. Article 59 of the statute states that the court's decision binds only the parties to that specific controversy. It's not like the U.S. Supreme Court, where every ruling sets a hard, binding precedent. However, in practice, to ensure consistency, the court relies heavily on its own previous decisions, treating them with great respect, even if it is not strictly bound by them.
This entire deep dive has been an exercise in understanding the constraints, the legal ideal versus the political reality.
That's the tension. The ICJ is the authoritative voice on international law between states. It can issue legally binding rulings and is essential for clarifying complex legal norms. However, its practical impact is always, always subject to the political calculations and, crucially, the veto power of the most powerful member states within the UN Security Council. It is a court that defines global legal obligations without possessing global police power.
And defining those obligations is often its most effective tool, even without enforcement. Take the climate change advisory opinion. Even if it's non-binding, it creates a powerful legal reality that nations must then confront.
It raises the political cost of inaction. Once the ICJ states definitively that a certain level of emissions violates a state's obligations, any state that ignores that ruling is doing so not just against humanitarian consensus, but against the highest legal authority in the world.
That perfectly encapsulates the tension. We've established the court's foundation, the tricky balance of its composition, and its major hurdle: the lack of independent enforcement.
It shows that even the highest court in the world is fundamentally constrained by the consent of the powerful, a reality woven right into the fabric of the UN Charter.
We mentioned earlier that the ICJ statute lists the sources of law the court can apply: treaties, custom, general principles. This means the court must stick rigidly to what the law is, even if the law is imperfect or unjust in a specific circumstance.
Right.
Yet, I wonder, is there any mechanism buried deep in its rulebook that allows it to operate purely on the basis of what is simply right?
You're setting up the final challenge for the learner, aren't you? You're referring to the power to decide a case ex aequo et bono.
Yes. The court is given the freedom under Article 38 of its statute to decide a case ex aequo et bono. Translated from Latin, that means out of equality and for the good. It is a radical concept, essentially allowing the court to decide based purely on equity and fairness, even if it falls strictly outside existing legal frameworks, provided the parties agree.
And as of January 2025, the court has never used this provision in its history, not once. States have never granted the ICJ this total authority to act as a court of pure conscience.
Exactly. Given all the political maneuvering, the use of the veto, and the historical lack of independent enforcement that we've discussed, all the compromises the court has to make, what would it take for states, for the collective global community, to finally trust the world court with the authority to issue a ruling based purely on that ideal of justice, independent of existing law? What kind of global crisis or what kind of political evolution would finally unlock that provision? That is something truly worth thinking about as you reflect on the limits of global law. Welcome back to The Deep Dive, where we take your stack of sources, strip away all the jargon, and, well, turn that information overload into pure distilled insight.
It's good to be here.
Today, we are taking a pretty exhilarating high-altitude journey. We're looking at a concept that is rapidly migrating from the pages of science fiction to, well, in industrial engineering reality.
We really are.
Orbital AI infrastructure.
Indeed. We are witnessing what could be the start of the greatest migration of critical computing hardware in human history. I mean, literally moving our most power-hungry infrastructure off the planet entirely.
And the reason for this massive shift, it isn't some desire for, you know, prestige or secrecy. It's actually a shockingly mundane and immediate crisis.
It's electricity.
Electricity. When you look at the stack of sources we compiled for this, the message is just unequivocal. Electric power has become the main bottleneck for AI infrastructure here on Earth.
That's right.
It's not the speed of the chips anymore or the genius of the algorithms. It's the fundamental inability of our global power grids to continuously feed these insatiable learning machines.
And what's really critical here and what all the sources underline is the scale and the sheer speed of this shift. Just, what, 3 or 4 years ago? The conversation was all about Moore's law, transistor density, processing speed.
Right.
Now, the sheer unrelenting thirst of training these large language models, the LLMs, it's paralyzing corporate expansion.
So companies literally can't build data centers fast enough.
They can't find places to build them because these centers demand hundreds of megawatts each, and they are fundamentally straining local, even regional power supplies. The sources frame this as an electricity supply bottleneck. And if it's not solved, and solved fast, it directly threatens the dominance of nations leading the AI race.
So, okay. That defines our mission for this deep dive. We're analyzing the proposals, the powerful drivers, the staggering scale, and of course, the inevitable risks of moving our computing destiny off-world.
We are talking about space-based data centers. Orbital AI infrastructure.
So for you listening, let's define that. What are we actually talking about here?
Right. So these are not just, you know, a few servers strapped to a satellite. These are proposed modular, massive AI data centers. Mm-hmm. And they're designed to use continuous, high-efficiency, space-based solar power.
And they have a specific target location.
A very specific one. Sun Synchronous Orbit, or SSO. And they're often carefully placed right above the dawn-dusk transition zone of the planet.
It sounds incredibly precise and probably very expensive.
Oh.
Why that exact spot? What is so magical about the dawn-dusk transition?
It's all about elegance. It's the perfect alignment of orbital geometry and energy capture. So imagine the Earth spinning, right?
Okay.
The Sun Synchronous Orbit is designed so the satellite passes over the same spot on Earth at the same local time every single day. So if you park your solar array right above that boundary where the sun is either always just rising or always just setting.
The Terminator line.
Exactly, the Terminator line. If you're there, you are, by definition, bathed in constant, perpetual sunlight.
So the satellite is basically surfing the twilight zone, and it never, ever dips into the Earth's shadow.
Precisely. Unlike satellites in low Earth orbit, which, you know, they cycle through maybe 45 minutes of sun, 45 minutes of darkness, a well-placed SSO satellite gets its solar efficiency up to nearly 100%. You never experience night.
And that is the single biggest constraint for solar power down here on the ground.
It's the killer.
Okay, that makes perfect sense from an energy perspective. But it still begs the question. This is a colossal undertaking. People have been talking about space solar power for decades. What makes moving millions of pounds of computing hardware viable now?
It's one thing. The single most important enabling factor, the one that shifts this whole conversation from theoretical physics to, well, engineering practicality.
And that is?
The economic revolution of reusable rockets. Mm-hmm. The sources are crystal clear on this. Because of the monumental advancements in reusable launch vehicles, systems that can launch, land, and relaunch quickly, the cost per kilogram to orbit has just fallen off a cliff.
So it's finally cheap enough to consider.
It's becoming cost competitive. The huge cost of the launch is finally being offset by the massive operational savings you get from free power and cooling.
Okay, let's unpack that. This shift from, you know, pure theory to something that's about to become reality. Where did this idea even come from?
Well, the deep history of this idea of space-based computing, it actually predates modern AI entirely. Its DNA is really found in those mid-20th century visions for large orbital industrial systems.
So we're talking big, grand sci-fi concepts.
Big concepts, yeah. Orbital manufacturing, things like that. But the main driver was always harvesting energy, the original idea of space-based solar power.
And the sources bring us back to the intellectual architects of that era, people like Isaac Asimov.
Exactly. Asimov, starting back in the 1940s, he popularized these ideas in his technical essays and, of course, in his science fiction. His story Reason had these huge orbital solar power collectors.
And the core motivation for these early thinkers, what was it?
They wanted to exploit the fundamental physics of space. Things we see as hostile to life, but that are actually ideal for machines.
Like the vacuum.
The vacuum, yes. Continuous, unfiltered solar energy, the unique thermal environment. They recognized that space offered conditions for power and for thermal management that were just impossible to replicate on Earth, at least not efficiently.
So the theory was there 70 years ago. Fast forward to today. What was the catalyst that took Asimov's dream off the shelf and put it into an actual project plan?
It was a perfect storm, a convergence of a few key 21st century technologies. First, the incredible miniaturization of computing small satellites, high-density chips.
Okay.
Second, that dramatic drop in launch costs we just talked about. And third, you pair all that with the relentless exponential demand for high-performance computing on the ground.
The AI boom.
The AI boom. So smaller, cheaper, faster launch capacity meets a demand for compute power that is doubling, maybe tripling, every single year.
That sounds like an inflection point.
It is. And it's led governments and private companies to explore these platforms for really practical, modern applications. You know, secure data handling, edge computing, low latency processing of Earth observation data.
That makes a lot of sense. If a satellite collects petabytes of climate data, why send it all the way back down to Earth?
Exactly. That process introduces delays. It takes up huge bandwidth. Why not just process it in situ, right there in orbit, and beam down only the compressed, actionable insights?
That low latency argument is really compelling, especially for real-time things like disaster response or autonomous systems.
Well, sure.
But the sources highlight a really critical milestone in 2025. Something that proves this isn't just a concept paper anymore.
That's the real turning point. The sources confirm it. In 2025, a company named StarCloud deployed an NVIDIA H100 class system into orbit.
The H100. For you listening, that is the flagship state-of-the-art GPU platform. It powers almost all modern AI training. It is the most sensitive, most expensive, most power-hungry hardware there is.
Right. And putting one of those through the intense vibration and G-forces of a launch, that is a massive engineering feat.
So what did StarCloud achieve with it?
It was a multifaceted achievement. First, it made StarCloud the first company to successfully train a large language model, an LLM, in space.
Wow.
And even more striking, they confirmed they were able to run a functional version of Google Gemini in orbit.
So this basically proves it can be done.
It proves several things. That the hardware can survive the launch, that the power, the cooling, the communications, it all works outside the atmosphere.
Huh.
And that the entire AI training and inference pipeline can actually function in the void of space.
So that 2025 date, that's a line in the sand. It's the moment the race to industrialize orbit officially started. Okay, now we get to the core of it. Why? Why endure the immense headache, the expense, the risk of launching a data center into space? And it all comes back to these irresistible advantages.
It does.
Let's spend some real time on the central driver, the energy boost.
If electricity is the bottleneck, orbit is a near-perfect solution that's just, well, designed by physics. The first, most obvious factor is the raw intensity of the energy available up there.
You mean the sunlight is just stronger?
Exactly. Solar irradiance, the raw power of the sun hitting the panels, is 36% higher in Earth orbit than it is on the surface.
36%? In the world of energy where you're fighting for single-digit gains, 36% isn't just massive. That's a complete game changer.
It is a phenomenal margin. And that's before we even talk about continuity. As we said, you put these platforms in that specific sun-synchronous orbit, tracking the dawn-dusk line.
You get continuous sunlight.
Full output, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
So you get a third more power, and you get it nonstop.
Mm.
What does that do to the financials of a data center?
It completely changes the financial model. Especially when it comes to battery storage.
Right. On Earth, you need massive batteries for nighttime and cloudy days.
Massive utility-scale battery arrays. They are incredibly expensive. They're heavy. They degrade over time. And they take up a ton of space. By getting 247 solar in orbit, you entirely eliminate the need for billions of dollars in batteries.
So that saving helps pay for the expensive launch.
It helps offset the high initial capex, yes. That's the real economic killer app. It's not just generating power, it's removing the most expensive part of terrestrial solar. And like you said, you also eliminate weather. No clouds, no dust, no storms.
You're creating an off-the-grid ecosystem that doesn't put any load on our fragile terrestrial power grids.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's the power side.
Yeah.
But the second massive pain point for data centers, especially high-density ones, is cooling. AI chips are thermal monsters. Cooling them takes absurd amounts of energy and, critically, water.
huge quantities of water. And this is another place where the physics of space becomes this really elegant solution. On Earth, you're using vast energy to run chillers, pump liquids, operate huge cooling towers.
All consuming precious resources.
Right. In space, radiative cooling is the dominant force, and it operates with near-perfect efficiency compared to Earth systems.
Let's explain that. How does the vacuum help you get rid of heat?
So radiative cooling relies on a simple principle. Any warm object sheds heat as infrared radiation. In the vacuum of space, there's no air, so you get rid of convection and conduction.
The main ways heat moves around on Earth.
Right, so you have this huge temperature difference between a hot server and the extreme cold of deep space. You just design these massive radiator panels that face away from the sun, and the heat just radiates away into the void.
You're using the universe as your heat sink.
You've got it. And the sources even mention specialized concepts like liquid droplet radiators or LDR.
Okay, that sounds fascinating.
They are. They work by circulating a fluid, sometimes a liquid metal, and then spraying tiny droplets of it into the vacuum. The droplets rapidly shed heat through radiation, and then you capture the cooled droplets.
To maximize the surface area for heat rejection.
Far beyond what a solid radiator can do. So the energy needed for cooling is dramatically reduced. You're relying on fundamental physics, not brute force mechanical chilling.
What's the catch? Is there a limit?
Surface area. It's all about surface area. That's why these structures have to be so vast. And you have to worry about hot spots, so you need intricate heat piping systems. And with LDRs, well, you need incredibly precise fluid systems so you don't just spray your coolant into the void forever.
So it solves one problem, but creates a new, very high-stakes fluid mechanics problem.
It's a trade-off, absolutely.
Okay, let's shift from physics to logistics. When you build a data center on Earth, you have zoning laws, land acquisition, environmental impact statements, taxes. It can delay a project for years.
Yeah.
And orbital infrastructure just bypasses all of that. The sources highlight several huge practical benefits. First, scalability. Space is, well, truly the limit. You're not constrained by real estate prices in Northern Virginia.
You're also freeing up land on Earth that could be used for housing or agriculture.
And third, the financial draw. You completely avoid property tax, local utility fees, land use regulations. It's a massive utility operating in an environment with zero municipal or state-level regulatory overhead.
Okay, let me challenge that. Even with reusable rockets, the launch costs are still immense. How can avoiding property tax possibly justify that?
It's a fair question. You're not just offsetting property tax. You are offsetting the total cost of continuous power and continuous cooling, plus the enormous expense of terrestrial battery backup.
It's an operational expense argument.
Exactly. The OPEX of running a terrestrial data center dominated by power and cooling, it quickly surpasses the CAPEX of building it. By eliminating the power bill and slashing the cooling bill, the whole ROI calculation changes. The massive launch cost becomes a one-time investment that's recouped much faster through perpetual, free, high-efficiency energy.
So it's a long-term financial play. That makes it feel less like a fantasy and more like a necessary, financially sound next step for AI growth.
It is a necessary next step. But, well, as with any extreme environment, there's a price of admission. We have to confront the harsh realities. Space is hostile, it's unforgiving, and the cost of failure is astronomical.
Literally and figuratively. Okay, yes. Let's start with the money. The sources explicitly say high launch costs are still a huge constraint. What does that mean for the hardware you're sending up?
It means every single component, from a structural beam to a microchip, has to justify its mass. The initial capital expenditure is just immense, which puts this technology strictly in the hands of the world's wealthiest entities.
And you can't afford to launch cheap parts if it costs millions to replace them.
Exactly. It puts an enormous premium on reliability and density.
So, assuming they can afford the trip, the hardware then has to survive a brutal ascent and then just exist in this high-risk environment forever.
Right. And there's a sequence of stresses. First, the launch itself. It's a violent, high-G, high-vibration environment. You have to meticulously engineer everything so your sensitive GPUs don't just shake apart.
And you have to assemble it in orbit.
Almost entirely with robotics and remote management, linking these massive modules together thousands of kilometers above us. And once it's built, the environment itself is a constant antagonist, specifically radiation.
Right.
The systems are just constantly being bombarded with cosmic rays and solar flares. This can cause long-term degradation, but it can also cause immediate catastrophic failures. The sources specifically warn about single event upsets or SEUs.
Can you break down what an SEU is for you?
Okay.
Listening.
Sure. Think of your computer memory as storing information as electrical states, zeros, and ones. An SEU happens when a high-energy particle, basically a tiny high-speed bullet from space, slams into a microchip.
And flips a bit.
It deposits just enough charge to flip a single bit from a zero to a one, or one to a zero. It's a spontaneous, random bit flip.
And that single flip could crash a whole training run, corrupt your data, or introduce a critical error into a calculation.
Precisely. Which means you need specialized, radiation-hardened components, hyper-redundant memory, and elaborate error-checking protocols built into everything. You can't just use off-the-shelf parts.
Which leads directly to the ultimate problem, maintenance. On Earth, if a power supply fails, a technician swaps it out in minutes. What happens in sun-synchronous orbit?
Maintenance, as we know it, is basically impossible. If a server rack fails up there, you're looking at needing advanced robotics for a repair mission, or, more likely, you just let it die and rely on the redundancy you built into the system.
So the whole design philosophy has to change.
It shifts from repairable to disposable, modular, and extremely durable. The electronics, the solar panels, they all have a limited, non-repairable lifespan.
Okay, let's talk systemic threats. The sources mention the catastrophic risk of runaway space debris, the Kessler syndrome. Why is that such a major concern for these AI mega constellations?
Kessler syndrome describes a scenario where the density of objects in orbit gets so high that one collision triggers a cascading chain reaction.
A domino effect.
A very fast, very destructive domino effect. Two large objects hit, they shatter into thousands of pieces, each one traveling at orbital velocity, and each piece can then destroy another satellite, leading to an exponential increase in debris.
And if you have companies launching modules that represent square miles of solar arrays, you're dramatically increasing the amount of mass in that orbital belt.
You're creating a massive negative externality. Every launch increases the probability of starting that cascade. If it were triggered, it could render key orbits, including that highly desirable SSO path, unusable for centuries.
So what's the solution?
Mandatory, verifiable end-of-life plans. Every single module has to be designed to deorbit itself safely, which, of course, adds more cost and complexity.
And then there are data constraints. The whole point is high-speed AI.
Yeah.
But doesn't being in orbit create a bottleneck for getting data up and down?
It absolutely does. Orbit imposes severe limits on data transfer latency and bandwidth. Training an LLM means moving petabytes of data. Even with advanced microwave links, there's a limit. And the distance creates unavoidable lag.
So things like laser communication are key.
They're essential. But sending petabytes of training data up and down fast enough without any loss is a huge engineering hurdle. You've basically traded the terrestrial power problem for a potentially crippling data transmission problem.
You solve the cooling and power only to face the data transfer problem head on.
It's the new frontier. If you're only using the orbital center for inference, just running the model, the data need is low. But if you're using it for training, that communication link becomes your new bottleneck.
And finally, a big negative externality for science. These massive constellations could severely inhibit observational astronomy.
This is a huge issue. It puts high-tech industry directly against fundamental science. The problem is the sheer size and reflectivity of these structures.
Satellite flares.
Exactly. The huge solar arrays, the radiator panels, they create these bright moving streaks in the sky. When they pass through the field of view of a ground-based telescope, they just overwhelm the sensitive optics and can ruin an entire night of observation.
It's light pollution, but generated in space.
That's a perfect way to put it. And it also threatens future space-based telescopes. Every new square mile of satellite is another obstacle for deep space viewing. It forces a really critical debate. Do we sacrifice part of our ability to see the universe in order to feed the growth of AI? That's a massive ethical trade-off. And that discussion of risk and scale brings us right to section 4, understanding just how big this is and who is in this race to space.
Before we name names, we need a concrete metric for you to visualize the scale we're talking about. When we say massive, how big does the power infrastructure actually need to be?
We can use the gigawatt as a metric. The sources provide a really clear visual. To produce 1 gigawatt of power, that's roughly the output of a large nuclear power plant.
Enough to power a small city.
Right. To get that, you would need approximately 1 square mile of solar array in Earth orbit, assuming about 30% cell efficiency.
1 square mile. For perspective, that's like taking Manhattan Central Park, paving it over with solar panels and launching it into orbit. That's hundreds, maybe thousands of heavy lift launches just for the power system.
And that's before you even add the data center modules. It just underscores the monumental engineering challenge. Terrestrial data centers can use hundreds of megawatts each. If the AI industry keeps growing like this, it'll need dozens of gigawatts. We're talking about building orbital structures that will eventually measure tens of square miles.
These will be the largest things humanity has ever built.
By far, requiring fully robotic assembly and maintenance.
So who is actually taking this on? The sources list a who's who of global tech and aerospace. This isn't a startup game.
No, the roster is very instructive. It shows a convergence of launch capacity, hardware expertise, and AI demand. You start with the infrastructure owners, aerospace titans like Blue Origin and SpaceX.
Bezos and Musk.
Right. They have the essential heavy lift launch capacity. Without their reusable rockets, none of this is even remotely economical.
It's the classic dynamic. The people who build the highway are the first to set up towns along it. But we also see the core AI companies getting involved directly.
Precisely. NVIDIA, which makes the crucial H100 GPUs, is keenly involved. They have to make sure their hardware can even operate in this environment. Then you have the major AI developers, OpenAI, for instance.
Jan Altman's company.
Their involvement suggests a strong belief that relying on terrestrial power is just unsustainable for their long-term goals. They need to control their own destiny.
And that destiny requires unlimited power.
Exactly. And then you have the giants, who are both customers and builders. Google is prominent with Project Suncatcher, which is explicitly researching this. And of course, the early mover, StarCloud, who hit that 2025 milestone.
And we're seeing new players like Aetherflux trying to get in on this too.
We are.
The fact that you have aerospace firms, GPU makers, and top AI labs all investing at the same time, it's just a massive shared conviction.
The conviction is that the terrestrial energy bottleneck is a dead end. They are collectively betting the future of information processing on high orbit.
It's the ultimate example of disruptive innovation, but one that's driven purely by necessity.
It is. The capital, the engineering, and the necessity have finally aligned to take that decades-old Asimovian vision and make it a tangible industrial reality.
So as we land this deep dive, let's circle back. We've gone from a theoretical concept from the 1940s to training a massive AI model in space in 2025. And it's all driven by the simple, brutal fact that power on Earth has become unsustainable.
That really is the core takeaway. The scale of AI's energy thirst is pushing the frontier of computing infrastructure higher and higher. But, you know, what happens next is arguably even more disruptive than the servers themselves.
How so?
Well, if the computing centers move to space, the entire network supporting them has to follow that high-speed orbital data backbone.
Because right now, you still have that crippling latency and bandwidth problem getting data to and from Earth. The data pipeline is the new bottleneck.
Correct. So that bottleneck demands radically new solutions. This orbital infrastructure will rely on, and more importantly, it will drive the development of new communication tech. We're talking about things like high bandwidth laser communication in space and advanced microwave transmission just for inter-satellite links.
So this isn't just about point-to-point communication. It's about weaving a dedicated space-based data ecosystem.
Exactly. We're seeing the need for things like the space network and near-Earth network to evolve into a global high-capacity mesh. These AI centers will be the key nodes in a network that completely transcends Earth's atmosphere.
And that lays the groundwork for something even bigger.
It lays the critical foundation for the most visionary concept of all, the interplanetary internet.
So what's the final provocative thought we leave with you, the listener? What does the birth of this orbital infrastructure really signal for the future?
I think the real revolution might not just be where the servers sit. It's the creation of a fundamentally new high-speed orbital data backbone, one that's separate from and potentially faster than our existing terrestrial internet.
So we're not just extending the Earth's network into space.
We're building a parallel solar-powered communication grid in the void. This new orbital network will allow AI to scale, unbound by terrestrial constraints. It could create a separate informational plane that could eventually manage global data transmission, resource allocation, maybe even coordinate interplanetary missions. The next phase of the internet may not be underground or underwater. It might be thousands of kilometers above our heads.
Something for you to mull over the next time you look up at the night sky.